Morning. Some people missing without an excuse. You got to bring a note from mom next week. I can't sing a note, and I got this nice software that teach you how to sing, but it's PC, and I'm a Macintosh man. This is the door prize for anybody who would like to learn how to sing with the help of a computer. Oh, and Neil would like that. Oh, congratulations, sir. We'll look forward to your joining the choir. And here's a picture of me with my Mormon missionary friends, with whom I am meeting weekly and having a delightful time. They're just really fun. I have to maybe just make publicly clear that the Mormon religion is, I'm convinced, a cult. It's not a legitimate branch of the Christian church for a number of reasons. However, these young men that I'm meeting with are very, very open, and they are very interested in talking about Jesus Christ and about the Bible, and they're also very polite and very friendly, as you can see from the picture there. And my friend Wayne and I went over to a dinner at the church, the nearby Mormon meeting house, which is the local ward, on Friday night. And they had a big buffet dinner, and it was absolutely dull beyond imagination. It was very plain, ordinary, with these nice, folksy, friendly people living in kind of a 19th century cultural group, kind of ethnic ghetto. Very nice, friendly people, but not nearly as lively as you folks at all. And I think that's because we've got our theology down right. But there's a nice, big, huge Mormon church right down the street. And if you call them up, they can send a couple of missionaries over for lunch. And all you got to do is just tell them about Jesus and talk to them. And I think you'll enjoy it. Anyway, they're nice kids. I think that the Mormon church recently, in the last few years, has put on a lot of cosmetics to appear to be more mainstream Christian. There's a lot of hokey, embarrassing things in their history and in their doctrines and belief. However, I also think that among some of the younger Mormons, there's a real hunger to know reality and to check the truth and validity of Mormonism. And it was very hard to leave the Mormon church, but I think that there nevertheless is a lot of thoughtful behind-the-scenes inquiry going on. On Friday, one of the guys opened our conversation by saying to me, when the four of them came over, saying, we don't talk to anybody else the way we talk to you, which translates into, we're totally honest with you, and we trust you, and we're friends, so we'll share with you things that we don't share with anybody else, that's a pretty high compliment, I think, because they're a very secretive, controlling culture. Anyhow, maybe Anil should do the solo for us with his singing voice improves. We've got okay, we're at chapter 15 of Luke. Last week, Jesus had turned around in the middle of a big crowd of people following him, and he'd spoken to the whole crowd, a whole bunch of people tagging along. I think a lot of them were very curious, and they were very interested, and some of them probably wanted to know what it would be like to follow him, and he gave them this very strong word that, as I mentioned last week, this is not exactly seeker-friendly, when he said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother and wife and children and brother and sisters and his own life also, cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Count the cost. Whoever does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. So he turned around to the whole crowd and he said, yes, you're going to, but if you want to follow me, you better be prepared to give your whole entire attention to me for the rest of your life. And it might even cost you your life. And the demands are far greater. So think twice before you get involved with me. Pretty strong. You'd think it would drive a lot of people away. Now, there are no chapter divisions in Greek, so chapter 15 really follows right after this discussion. And chapter 14 closes with, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." One of those little invitations of the Lord where he says, if this interests you, don't leave. Hang on, and I'll give you some more. And that's what introduces chapter 15. Chapter 15 is one of the favorite chapters in the entire Bible. It's a perfect illustration of the key verse in Luke, which is, "The Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost." Not those who were lost, but that which was lost. That which was lost was the secret of humanity, the secret of wholeness, which is a relationship with Jesus Christ, living in union with Christ, in partnership with Him in daily life, and that's the secret of being a whole person. And the chapter 14 is about four lost things, or four kinds of lost people. So let's have a look. Now, last week I pulled out of Ray Stedman's sermons on the parables, I pulled out his three messages on these parables, and that was in last week's handout. And this week's handout's for next week, so you read ahead, and that's extra credit. But I don't keep the books here. So. All right, then notice how the, chapter 15 starts. "All the tax collectors and the sinners drew near to hear him." Out of this big crowd of people following him, which would be everybody, be little kids, it would be old people, it would be people from all walks of life, are tagging along with Jesus. And the people that come up to hear Jesus after this strong message about following him are a collection of tax collectors and sinners. You remember Matthew was one of those tax collectors that heard about Jesus and decided to follow Jesus and threw a big dinner party and gotten Jesus in big trouble way earlier. The tax collectors were generally Jewish citizens who hired themselves out to the Romans, and they collected the taxes on the land. The Romans told them how much money to collect per person per year, and the tax collectors then went out and collected whatever they thought the traffic would bear and gave Rome what Rome wanted and pocketed the rest. So they were crooks, loan sharks, greatly hated and despised. We don't like the IRS, but they're reasonably fair. But these tax collectors were not fair, and so they were absolutely really despised. So who would ever hang out with this kind of people, with these tax collectors? The other group of people here that are drawing up to Jesus are a group of sinners. Now, that would include people that are openly, publicly sinners, such as prostitutes or drunkards or lowlife, lepers. But it also would include just people that were not religious, people who didn't go to the temple, people who didn't pray. That in the eyes of the Pharisees, this would be people who had no interest in religion, so they're on the outside. So they're out that's low life. Now, the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, always murmured, constantly saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." What a ridiculous thing to do, to go hang out with these miserable wretches. Of course, Jesus has previously expressed interest in these miserable wretches and these outcasts, and if you are going to get to know them and help them, you have to go have dinner with them. And remember, Jesus was quite ready to go have dinner with anybody. Last week he had dinner with a bunch of very antagonistic Pharisees who were out to get him. So he's really very much unlike John the Baptist, who was much more austere. Jesus liked partying, as it were. He liked dinner invitations with anybody. And the Pharisees thought this was absolutely beneath their dignity as men of the cloth. But on the other hand, as Ray points out, the Pharisees admired Jesus in a way because he was a man who was intelligent, who was believed in the same thing that they believed in up to a certain point, believed in the God of Israel, the supernatural, and the law of Moses, and he never spoke inconsistently with the law of Moses. So I think that secretly the Pharisees would like to have Jesus join them and be one of them and renounce the Pharisees and the low life and go along with the party line. He's not doing that, obviously, and he's constantly antagonizing them. And Jesus spoke this parable to them. That would be to, he speaks the parable then, addressing it to the tax collectors and sinners within the hearing of the Pharisees. And this is one long parable, but it breaks up into three sections. What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost." I say to you that likewise there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 just persons who need no repentance. Sheep herding is a big thing in the Middle East, even to this very day. Shepherds were very much involved with the care of their sheep constantly, watching over them 24/7. A little bit different from modern sheep herding. What would be the main difference about a modern sheep herding enterprise? Probably be thousands of sheep, and it'd be a commercial operation, and you count the number of sheep at the beginning of the season, and then the number of the sheep at the end of the season, and then you say, well, we had a little loss this year from coyotes and wolves and accidents, and it's, that's money lost, but the sheep are not that important except to their commercial value. But that's not the way shepherds were in the Middle East. Every single shepherd would take care of his sheep as if they were his own family members. Now, how about sheep? What are sheep like? Yeah, Jesus did not choose cows or pigs or other animals, domestic animals, chickens. He picks a sheep. What are sheep like? Ever been around any sheep? They're very nice when they're little cuddly lambs. They're not bad when they're grown up. Nobody's home. That's good. Yes, that's really good about sheep. Nobody's there. They cannot take care of themselves at all. If they get turned upside down, they can't get back on their feet. They can easily wander stray right over the edge of a cliff. Then the other thing about a sheep is that he starts nibbling on the grass, and then he goes off over here because there's more and more and more good grass, and he keeps going. And the next thing you know, he's way far away from the rest of the sheep. Didn't intend to get lost, and then he gets absolutely terrified because he wants the company and security of the rest of the flock, but it's gone, and now he starts bleating with a loud voice, a bleat, and what does that do? Well, it attracts all the handy predators who come over, and just, and he's gone. What else about sheep?
Well, if they fall down, they can't get back up.
Can't get up, yep. Fall over. So you got to be there, put them back on their feet. They have absolutely no defenses whatsoever. No defenses. They don't run very fast. They don't know how to protect themselves. They're full of wool. They're good wool producers. What about ticks, insect bites, injuries? The shepherd has to go take care of them in that sense of a veterinarian or a doctor. At nighttime, what do you do? At nighttime, you take them into a stall, or you maybe a ring of rocks, and put them all in there, and then the shepherd sits in the gate, and that way they're all safe all night long inside. To this very day, if you go to Israel, and there are some of you, you'll see sheep and goats on the hills with a shepherd, and very much like ancient times. Now, in this particular parable, one out of 100 sheep gets lost. Amazing that the shepherd notices one out of 100. That's only 1%. Almost knows these sheep individually. Almost, you know, as if they were pets, you'd call them by name, but they're not smart enough to be very good pets. In a lot of parts of the world, you use sheepdogs to help you, because intelligent trained sheepdogs are really good at taking care of sheep. But this is really quite amazing that the shepherd is so concerned about this one lost sheep that strayed away that he stops everything, puts the 99 in some kind of a safe place, maybe with the care of another shepherd or something or other, and then he goes out on a long, difficult journey and hunts and hunts and hunts for this lost sheep who might be miles away. Maybe he's fallen over a cliff. Maybe he's been seized by a wolf or a coyote or a lion in the Judea wilderness. And it becomes a matter of utmost concern that this one sheep is found. And he finds it, finally. We don't know how long it took. Might have taken a long, long time. But that finding of that one sheep is immensely important. It's not the economic value of the sheep that matters here. That sheep is immensely important. And he brings that sheep back and tells all his friends and neighbors that his flock is complete. And they don't just say, ho-hum, gee, that's nice. Everybody's delighted. And now Jesus applies that immediately to sinners, to the joy that God himself feels, and then also all of the angels, when one sinner comes back to him, to the Lord. And there's great joy over the one lost sheep, greater than the joy over the 99 just, or sheep that are already safe in the fold. All right? I'll give you a little clue here. The three stories in here all have to do with the Trinity, a different person of the Trinity. This is the parable that emphasizes God the Son of God, who is the one who goes out to find the sheep. Now, if the sheep represent a lost person, if this wandering sheep represents a lost person, how did this person get lost? Also, who are the 99 just sheep? Is that the Pharisees? That's a popular view. Most people think they're the Pharisees. Grace Edmonds says that he, for many years, thought those were the Pharisees. Were the Pharisees truly just? No. They were self-righteous. Okay? So that all 100 sheep were presumably believers to start with here, or in the fold. They're under the care of the shepherd. And what happens to this one sheep? He wanders off. Is that easy to do as a Christian?
Yeah.
Got a new job, takes extra demands from you, extra time and energy, and you haven't got time to hang out with your fellow Christians or read the Bible, and you just get very busy. Or you move to a new town and you don't readily find yourself with a Christian community that you're comfortable with. You didn't intend to get away from God, but little by little by little you did. It's the first of the warnings in the book of Hebrews, remember, is about straying away from God little at a time without each individual step not recognizing that you're getting away. And then pretty soon you're way far away. That's pretty clear then that we need each other and we need the shepherd and we are as helpless as sheep. It's a beautiful picture then of us, isn't it? All right. The rabbis always said that it was a rather nice thing when a sinner would come to God. So the rabbis said, it's really great when a sinner turns to God. There's something fundamentally different here in this story told by the Son of God, and that is, this shepherd doesn't wait for people to come back. He goes and hunts people down. He goes and searches for the lost sheep, and that's the highest priority in his whole work, and he's very, very interested in that one person, and the other 99 are fine. See that? The incredible love that Jesus has for every single one of his sheep. And he will come and hunt you down. Great. There's a great long poem called about the Hound of Heaven, if you've seen that, where Jesus is like the sheepdog that tracks you down. Yeah, but I think we have to treat these parables a little bit lightly because the shepherd's got a flock here of 100 sheep, and they would all be professing believers at least. They'd all have put themselves under the care of the shepherd, and maybe some of them might, in the end, I don't think the issue of salvation is the real issue here. You kind of assume that they're all in the flock. So that the fact that this sinner, this one sheep ran straight away, would suggest that maybe he didn't really know the shepherd, but sheep don't know the shepherd very much anyway. So it's really not so much about salvation as it is about safety and security and under the care of the shepherd, in the care of the shepherd, and the tremendous love that the Son of God has for every single one, and how he takes the initiative to come and find those that have strayed away. See that in that parable? Isn't that a wonderful parable? Did you ever feel like that in your own life? And maybe you got just a little bit away from God, or even before you came to know God, did you feel like he was chasing you down? Did you feel his tender care and forgiveness? Look at the shepherd picks this sheep up and throws it over his shoulders, and then he may has to hike back a long distance through the wilderness until he gets to his sheepfold. And then this joy, this incredible joy about one lost sheep. And that's pretty neat about God, how every single member of the flock is of great personal interest to God. And the safety and well-being of that one sheep becomes a greater priority than the 99 who are already safe in the sheepfold. Kind of great. Great story. And are we not like the sheep? Yes. Are we not in need of a shepherd that takes the initiative in our care and our well-being and sets us on the right track and goes and finds us? And so this would represent then the person who didn't intend to get lost, who sort of strayed away but got in big trouble, didn't know how to get back. Sheep don't know how to go home if they get lost in the flock. If you don't go find them, they won't come back. You know, you try to get rid of your cat or your dog, that your cat or dog will find you if you've moved to Nebraska. Not a sheep. Okay? So that's a really tender, moving parable. And now, I suppose now the audience, these tax collectors and sinners that are listening to Jesus, how would they identify with this? They'd say, well, I'm lost. I grew up in a good family. I used to go to the temple services. I used to pray with my parents. And then, I don't know, but I got really far away from the things of God, and I'd like to be back in the comfort of the sheepfold again. So would there be a group of people in this crowd that listened to Jesus and heard him at this point? Yes. Yes. Not the Pharisees at this point. Scribes and Pharisees already got their little clique going. But there'd be a lot of people out there that were disenfranchised and alienated and that would listen to this message from Jesus. The second part of this story features the work of the Holy Spirit. And this is a different kind of lostness. And once again, I think Ray Steadman's sermons I gave you last week are really good here. What woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, and seek diligently until she finds it? When she has found it, she calls her friends and neighbors together, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the piece which I lost. Likewise, I say to you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." 8 times in this parable, Jesus talks about that which was lost. Now, here is a woman. Evidently, she might be a widow. Maybe she lives alone. And the houses over there, of course, were small houses with maybe one little window and a door and not much light inside. And she has this special little treasure of 10 coins and then counts them one day and one of them's missing. And it throws her into a great fuss inside. And everything stops. Now, there's a lot of discussion about the coins. They're silver coins, not gold. The coin may have been as much as a day's wage. It may not have been. One commentator says the coins were maybe 16 cents of value each. But there's another thing that I think probably fits pretty well, and that is Jewish women very often would take coins and collect them together and sew them onto the headdress that became their sort of bridal veil garment, kind of a keepsake special. So here's a woman then that has accidentally lost something that was a personal treasure to her. Did that ever happen to you? Lose something around the house and you just absolutely have got to find it? It's of sentimental value. It's a, and you're totally distracted. You can't do anything until you find it. So this is a person who gets lost at home. Okay? Do people get lost at home? Yes, they do. Do kids get lost while they're living with their parents? Do family members get lost while they're right in the middle of the family? Accidentally lost? And then suddenly somebody wakes up and says, I wonder how so-and-so is really doing. Now, the first thing the woman does is light a lamp. What does that mean? We need further light on this individual, your teenage son. Let's suppose your teenage son has been raised in the church, or your daughter, teenage daughter, and has supposedly made a commitment to the Lord and lives a fairly good moral life, and then suddenly you wake up and realize, gee, you know, we're not communicating like we used to. I wonder where he's really at, or I wonder where she's really at. If you're no high school and college kids today, it's pretty hard to tell where they're at. They're on the cell phone, and they're heavily influenced by peers, and they can put on a good front around the house, and maybe they used to go to church out of heartfelt enthusiasm, but now they go to church just out of duty, because you'll throw them out if they don't, and they put on their good behavior so they'll stay out of trouble. But you wake up one day and you say, something's not right here, and I don't know what it is. And the direct confrontation won't usually work. Put them on the defensive. No, Mom. No, Dad. I'm fine. That kind of fit? Now, what do? You light a lamp. That means we need more light on this. And then what do? You sweep the floor. Sweep the floor. What's that about? Let's clean up the house. Let's clean up our own life. Let's examine our family. Let's examine what we're doing with our time and our energy. Let's make a thorough search, and everything goes on hold. Everything goes on hold, and then lo and behold, suddenly the mystery is solved and the missing coin turns up, and the woman, having looked diligently for her lost coin, finds it, and then it turns around to there's more joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. So in this process, this lost person comes back to God. Now, anybody think of anything that's happened like that in your family or around anybody you know? Or somebody, or member of the family, somebody you love, a friend, kind of got lost like this? Forcing you to examine your life and your family circle, your living situation, and analyze and study and pray until you found the heart of the breakdown of communication or whatever it was that was wrong, and then you got it fixed, found it. All the time. Happens all the time, doesn't it? Things that get lost. People that get lost right at home. And you know, so many times a parent will say, My little girl made a profession of faith when she was 9 years old, and I just know she's a good Christian. Is there any fallacy in that? Well, yes, there is. That little profession of faith may or may not have been real, and we really can question her profession of faith if her whole lifestyle right now is gone to the dogs, and we talked to the neighbors and found out that our sweet little girl isn't quite so sweet after all. And she's not hanging out with a good crowd, and then we have to examine that little girl's life and say, where did she get out? Where did we go wrong? Where did she go wrong? How do we help her back? Those are the hard things we deal with. And so this is the parable that involves the Holy Spirit helping us, putting light on things, helping us to change our behavior, helping us to have insights into the other person that we've lost touch with. The coin sort of gets lost kind of accidentally. That's how things go wrong in families. You know, they not intentionally, they oftentimes. All right? The next parable, the next part of this parable, puts the highlight on what God the Father is like. So we're going to get the whole Trinity in here. Then he said, a certain man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. That is, I know when you die, I'll get your estate will be divided between my brother and I. And I'm the younger one, so in the Jewish culture, the older brother would get two-thirds of the estate, and the younger brother would get one-third of the estate. And now we have here a young man who's tired of living at home, and he's attracted by the world, and he wants to leave home and go out on his own. So he goes to his father and says, "Can I have my share of my inheritance now?" Is that an unusual request? Sure is. That's pretty out of line to try to get your dad's your share of your father's estate before he's even died. And this father complies. This is a loving, caring father. And how was he going to comply? Well, he's got to go get his house and his animals and his estate evaluated, and he's got to go and borrow a third of the total value of the money and get turned it into cash and give it to the kid. That's a pretty risky thing to do. That doesn't make good business sense, does it? And it's certainly out of line with ordinary way of doing things. But this is a loving father who wants to give his son a lot of slack and who understands what boys are like, and it's heartbreaking. Incidentally, it's Mother's Day, but in these parables, we don't know what's going on with Mom. We can guess that behind the scenes, she's the one that's really in anguish and in prayer in the bedroom and crying her eyes out. So we don't want to leave her out. But these patriarchal society, it's mostly about dads, which is fine. The younger said to his father, "Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me." So the man, the father, divided to them his livelihood. Now the young man goes and leaves home with a big pocket of money, gets on the Greyhound bus or buys himself a Honda or motorcycle or something, and he heads out for adventure and discovery. And so good to be out from under Mom and Dad and to have freedom to explore and see life, and I got money in my pocket so I can have a great time. Not many days after, the young man gathered everything together, packed everything, took everything with him, journeyed to a far country, and there he wasted his possessions with prodigal living. The word prodigal changed meaning over the years. It's interesting, the original Latin word that from which we get the word prodigal means lavishly generous. And it was a positive word. Now the word prodigal doesn't mean that anymore. It means wasteful. It means reckless expenditure of your resources. Well, kids do that. They've got a little money, and it's time to go live the good life and party it up. And he takes this one-third of his whole inheritance, and it didn't take him very long to spend it. Throws big parties, runs around and sees all the sights, meets a whole bunch of friends. You can have all kinds of friends if you get a little money in your pocket and you're willing to buy them drinks and take them to dinner. You'll get just all sorts of friends that hang on. Just really great. And he's the life of the party. And this is a good life. Trouble is that it's a finite, fixed amount of money. He hasn't invested it or anything like that. Doesn't have a savings account or doesn't have an ATM card. He's just got this bag of money. And before very long, the money runs out, and that's not the worst of it, because coincidentally, there arose a severe famine in the land, and he began to be in need. Now he's out of money, can't find a job, there's a big famine, there's a big crisis in the economy, there's a big line at the employment office, can't get a job. And he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country. And the man sent him into his fields to feed the swine. So he's gone a long ways away from home. He's gone away from the community of Israel over into one of the Gentile areas where they raise pigs. And pigs, of course, are unclean animals for the Jews. So this is the lowest kind of a job you could possibly get. Pigs are stinky and messy and not pleasant animals to be around. You got to go feed them most likely with carob seeds. Anybody know what carob seeds are? People, you can eat carob seeds. I think you can buy carob. I think it's chocolate-like, isn't it? And so people can eat carob seeds, and then, and it's good to feed the pigs, and they grow on trees. So in the time of famine, you probably have plenty of carob seeds, pods. He would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, but no one gave him anything. So the pig owner wouldn't even give him any of the pig food. No, you can't have any of my carob seeds. Those carob seeds are intended for the pigs, young man. This is pretty bad. So he's getting hungry. He's dirty. He's the end of himself. And that's exactly what happens when he came to himself, when he came to his senses. Perhaps there's no other way that some people can come to their senses but to waste their living and their life and come to dead end and come to total ruin. And maybe that's the only way that works for some people. How do the parents feel back home? Absolutely brokenhearted, of course. Any parent does. And you would love to have it go differently. And he came to himself and he said, how many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? Father, probably pretty rich, had hired servants. And it's a time of famine and hardship, and his father's estate has dropped in value by one third, but the man is still probably prosperous, and he's got his hired servants, and he takes care of his hired servants. And so this son says, oh my gosh, my dad's servants back at home are eating better than I am, and they've got a nice clean place to sleep, and I sure wish I could just go work for my dad as a servant, and I wouldn't have to feed the pigs, but I could go feed some of the sheep or something. He says, I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. There's two things that come into this guy's mind. What he has done was wrong in the eyes of God. His disobedience to his parents, his squanderous lifestyle, that all of the sins that he got into and his waywardness, he has sinned against God and he has sinned against his father. And he sees that. That's, of course, what repentance is all about. It's this realization that you have offended God by what you've done, and you've also hurt and offended other people that love you and care about you. And he sees that in his heart. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So he makes up this little speech. He's going to go home, and he's going to go to his dad, maybe dad watching television late at night, and he's going to knock gingerly on the door, poke in the window, and he's got this little speech made up. Father, it would sure be nice if you could help me a little bit. I've really done wrong, both with God and with the family, but I'm really in big trouble now. So he has this speech all made up, probably rehearsed it 10 times over, just got the word absolutely right. He rose and came to his father. Long journey, long ways, with his backpack. When he was still a great way off, down the hill, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. The word kissed there means kissed intensely or repeatedly. Obviously, passionately, kissed him. So the father comes running after the kid. That's really amazing, isn't it? The father heart of God is like that. Desperately longs for the sinner to come running back for help. Unconditionally received. The son said to him, son starts his little speech now. Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. ... Father won't let him finish this little speech. His father said to his servants, calls up immediately to the servants back at the house, and he says, bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fatted calf here. Special fatted calf for special important visitors. And kill it and let us eat and be merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found, and they began to be merry. Isn't that awesome? But that's what God's like. And that's the father heart of God towards sinners, no matter how far down the pole of the totem pole they've gotten and how destitute they are. Father comes with open arms to receive. And there's no probation here. There's no scolding. There's no lecture. There's no, well, son, I think we could probably put you out there in the little shack out back and I'll give you a small sum of money and you can maybe, but don't come in the house. And you stink, so you got to go take a bath. And then your mother and I will talk about this, and we'll see if we could give you a little help. But I think probably you should go live someplace else. Nope, none of that. There's this suddenly great big lavish feast, as if this lost son was the most important distinguished visitor anywhere that had come back. And the father, you kind of get an idea of what's been going on in the father's heart all this time. Father's been brokenhearted and full of anguish over his lost son. And so delighted that his son is back. To him, it's life and death. It really is. This son of mine was dead. For all practical purposes, he was dead. We'd lost all touch with him. We didn't get an email from him. He didn't send any postcards. Didn't get any Mother's Day cards, no Christmas cards. We didn't hear a word from him. We didn't get any reports. He was totally gone. As if he'd never existed. And now suddenly he's back. It's absolutely too good to be true. Prodigal son. Well, we all use the term prodigal son now all the time. About the young man or young woman who runs out and lives a dissipative, wild, reckless life. Deliberately giving up the family relationships that he had and going out and doing his own thing. And what a heartbreaking thing it is. And sometimes how you, as parents, you're unable to stop it from happening. And you pray, and sometimes the kid comes back, and sometimes he doesn't. And here's this wonderful story of the kid who comes to his senses and comes back. The sinners out there in listening to Jesus would like this. That would have a certain appeal to them, wouldn't it? These really people out there that were lost, that had come maybe from good homes and families, and suddenly they realized that they had sinned against God and they had sinned against their parents. And would their parents take them back? Would God take them back? Well, now it ought to be pretty clear that God will take them back, no strings attached. I'm one of those true prodigal sons like that, because in my early Christian life I got away from God for 7 years and went down into the bottom rungs of life. And when I came back and asked the elders and PVC for forgiveness, that Ray and others threw a big party for me with a sports coat and I think Woodall cooked lamb. And I got Richie made me my gold prodigal son ring. And I told him about my wayward years and they talked about praying for me. And Elaine said, if you've been judged, we've all been judged and we're so happy to have you back. And I came back to PVC, and there weren't any demons here, and there weren't any ogres. And I'd had a lot of problems with Ray before, but now he was very fatherly, and we both changed. And so that story has a happy ending. That's 30 years ago, I guess, now. So this prodigal son, this part of the story is just no problem for me at all, because I've been there. And I know what a wonderful feeling it is to have God's unconditional fatherly love when you should have died. I know that. Now, that's not the end of the story. It's not even probably the most important part of the story, because we get verse 25. His older son was in the field, and he came and drew near to the house, and he heard music and dancing. Uh-oh. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. What's going on up at the big house there on the hill? He said to him, your brother has come, and because he has received him safe and sound, your father has killed the fatted calf, says the servant. The older son was angry and would not go in. Therefore, his father came out and pleaded with him. Now the father's got another job on his hand, a harder one, a more difficult one with his well-behaved son that stays at home. He answered and said to his father, lo, these many years I've been slaving away for you. I have never, ever transgressed your commandment. Ever, ever. Never told a lie. I've never done anything. I've always turned out the lights at 10:30 and shut off the TV. I never played loud rock music. I, I always mow the lawn when you tell me to. You have a big lavish party. You never did that for me. I'd like to make merry with my friends. Well, he probably has done that, but he doesn't remember it. But just as soon as this son of yours who has devoured your livelihood, this son of yours, no brother of mine, has devoured your livelihood, what a reckless thing of you to do as a father to let this happen. That's not good management over the resources. And he has devoured your livelihood with harlots. We don't know. He might have. And you throw this big party for him when he comes home. Now that's ridiculous, Dad. That's out of, Father, you're out of line. And the father said to him, Son, you're always with me. All that I have is yours. It was right that we should make merry and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again and was lost and is found. Is this second son lost also? Yes, he is. Why is he lost? Why is he more difficult to reach? He is self-righteous. I looked through Ray's signs of self-righteousness that Ray describes as the three signs of self-righteousness. Number one, I have been treated unfairly, ignored, and neglected. Number two, I have an over-inflated sense of self. Number two. Number three, I have contempt for others and I blame others. And I thought through that list, wow, I'm that son too. Golly, I've been treated unfairly many times. I am, after all, really, really important and knowledgeable. And there's a lot of these other people around are really second rate. So I'm not getting a fair treatment in life at all either. And so look at my own life and here's all this self-righteousness in me too. So I can't just say that I'm like number one son, because I also find myself, now that I'm back with the Lord a while, I'm got this self-righteousness seething up in me. So this is the fourth of four lost things in this book. Okay? Did anybody here identify with any of this? How about, now Jesus has the first of these three great events have a big appeal to the tax collectors and the sinners. And then right at the end, Jesus slams the Pharisees pretty heavy duty. They get all caught up in this story and they're saying, oh boy, this doesn't apply to me and this doesn't fit us at all. And then right at the end, there's this the son that stayed at home and his self-righteousness and his arrogance. And that's got to slam the Pharisees really big time, right? And catch them too. And that's how Jesus is when he's talking to people. He's got something there for everybody. So maybe you can find yourself here in one of these lost people. Yeah. Yep. The equal treatment. The self-righteous, stay-at-home, well-behaved son is treated with the same lavish love. Yes. He's more difficult to reach because he doesn't know his need as much. Yeah. And he's going to end up with two-thirds of the estate. And now that the younger son is back, they'll probably have to juggle the mortgage and figure out what to do now because the dad isn't dead yet. So put the younger son to work. And maybe we can build up the value of the whole estate here. But that's about there's the father heart of God in this last. It's interesting that the person who tells us about the father heart of God is Jesus, the Son. The Son, the obedient Son of God, is the one who tells us about the Father and what the Father's heart is like. That's pretty assuring, isn't it? He who has seen me has seen the Father. So if you want to know what your God, your Father, is like, you go to Jesus and you'll see in Jesus that compassionate, caring heart that will bring you back into the fold and make you whole. Any other thoughts on this? We have no tax collectors here today. We have no sinners. We have no Pharisees here. We just have the 99. Yes, it would have been. The honor and reputation of the family rests on the sons, and that's absolutely true. The son deserved to be disowned or to be put to death to save the honor of the family. Yes. Father, thank you for this just incredible parable from the Lord Jesus, addressed to a crowd that was all-inclusive, these very moving accounts of lost people. And the wonderful, caring, loving heart of God that seeks to heal and to restore and to forgive, the mercy and grace that you're ready to extend to all of us. Father, I pray that we could all just be aware of our need of mercy and grace daily. Help us also to be attentive to the things around us where we live, in our homes and families, with our own friends and relatives, that there could be healing and restoring there, with friends and family members who are lost like the lost coin. And Father, make us aware of our own self-righteousness and our own holier-than-thou attitude, and the ease with which we can get into a I am holier-than-thou frame of mind, when we always need your mercy and grace. Thank you just for this amazing love that never ceases, that's always there for us. And help us just to learn how to flee into your arms and come to you when we need help of any kind. Well, thanks for these great stories and our time together today. In the name of Jesus. Next week, chapter 16.